You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Culture Map presents... What's Eric Eating? From the Gal Media Studios in Houston, Texas, here's Culture Map food editor Eric Sandler.
Welcome to What's Eric Eating, Culture Map's weekly food-oriented podcast. My name is Eric Sandler. I'm the food editor for Culture Map. I'm joined this week by my friend, La Olivier owner Mary Clarkson. Mary, how are you?
I'm doing great, Eric. Thank you for having me today.
Hey, thanks for joining us. Before we get into the news of the week, I just want to talk for just a minute about La Olivier, because I know you just celebrated your five-year anniversary. Could you just tell the listeners a little bit about, give us the 45-second version of what the restaurant is and where you're located?
Sure. We're located in the heart of Montrose on 240 Westheimer. Chef Olivier is Burgundy-born, three-star Michelin-trained chef. That's been in Houston for over 20 years now. He was the former executive chef of Tony's for 12 years, so a lot of people here know him. Our cuisine is definitely French-oriented. I would say it has a European twist to it. There's a lot of homemade pastas, a lot of Italian, European influences, as well as a little touch of the South. We have a cold bar, raw bar, so a lot of seafood items that are on the menu. A lot of people think French food is heavy, but actually there's a lot of light seafood dishes on the menu. And then I think the thing we're probably most well known for these days is our fried chicken and champagne happy hour on Wednesdays, which is a real treat. Olivier marinates the chicken for 4 days. It's extra spicy, and it's always kind of a surprise to see people enjoy that for the first time.
And you have a great sparkling wine selection, which always goes great with that. Fried chicken. All right. So let's, it's been a busy week despite the holiday. There were a lot of things going on. I want to hit these, I want to hit this first item just kind of briefly. Lopez Mexican Restaurant, a Southwest Houston institution, has announced that after 40 years in business, they're going to open a second location with Mattress Mac out at the Gallery Furniture location on the Grand Parkway. Mary, have you been to Lopez? Are you familiar with its reputation?
I'm familiar with its reputation. I have been. I think this is kind of an exciting twist. I don't know how often I'm going to get out to Grand Parkway, but I will definitely go and check it out.
Yeah, just a super classic Tex-Mex, you know, great boozy frozen margaritas. Enchiladas are some of the best around. It's just an exciting new opportunity for a family that's been doing things the right way for a long time. And then I'd like, moving on, a little bit of personnel drama. Omar Perini, the former chef of Pesca, has sued them to release him from his non-compete agreement that he signed when he was working there, as well as a name and likeness agreement that allowed them to market him as a personality. Omar has hosted a cooking show on the Latin American version of the Food Network. He's kind of a famous name if you look at his social media following. It's pretty extensive. Mary, as a restaurateur, why do restaurants sign chefs to non-compete agreements?
Ooh, this is a tough one. My kind of idea about this is a smaller restaurant isn't going to have chefs. They're not going to have chefs sign these as often as maybe a corporate or a larger restaurant that's been around a long time. Chefs sign them because they want the opportunity to work for whatever establishment they're negotiating with. And, you know, arguably they don't have a lot of leverage when they're being asked to sign these. I've always told chef friends of mine, don't sign these if you don't have to. Texas is a state that is more likely than not going to enforce an agreement like this. Non-competes are very tough and expensive to enforce.
Have you ever heard of someone who's subject to a non-compete preemptively suing to be released from one? That was a new one for me.
Ooh, no. You know, I mean, the last one that I kind of remember, and you wrote about it, was Bobby Matos, I believe.
Right. When he left Ciao Bello to go to State of Grace, Tony Vallone filed suit against him, but it was dismissed pretty quickly.
It was dismissed pretty quickly, and Bobby had the benefit of having partners, investors in his restaurant that could afford attorney's fees, which quickly helped settle the matter. Chef preemptively doing it, I think that's probably attributed to this chef's particular background, that he was already very, very well known before, and he needs to be able to use his name and likeness in the future because he's already established and he's well known, so he wants to protect that. I get scared a little bit for these chefs when they sign and then find themselves in this type of situation, but he's protecting his name and it's worth protecting.
Now, what's interesting to me about this is that, you know, Pesca changed directions. It had been a very seafood-oriented restaurant. You know, they brought in some new operating partners, changed to more of a steak and seafood concept. And that's, you know, as I understand it, that's what prompted Omar to elect to leave. As a restaurateur, why would you seek to enforce a non-compete when it's not like Omar's going to go open a steakhouse and compete with you?
I think, you know, if anything, I mean, for me, it's almost considered, I guess, a form of punishment in a sense, especially if he's given them assurances that he's not going to go open a similar concept. Perhaps they're worried about him opening just any type of concept nearby, and that's maybe what they want to prevent. I don't know if there was a mile radius on this, but a lot of times there's a circumference that they can't operate within 3 miles of the restaurant or something.
Yeah, no,
like
this one's pretty punitive. It's within, as I recall reading the document, it's within the city limits of Houston or 20 miles outside of it, which seems like a lot.
Yeah, I mean, so another background of me is I'm an attorney. So a judge is not likely going to enforce such a general wide encompassing area limiting a chef's ability to work. We'll see what happens, but judges like non-competes and name and likeness agreements to be very narrowly tailored, and this doesn't seem like it fits that criteria.
Yeah, when I spoke to the restaurant's attorney, he said, look, we just want to know what Omar wants to do, and then we'll tell him whether or not we think that's okay.
Yeah, that's not a fun place to be if you're the chef.
Right. If you're trying to get a new business off the ground, better to get the whole thing struck and just start clean, right?
Absolutely.
And then this one stings a little bit. I know we've talked quite a bit about Hunky Dory and Bernadine's closing, but we haven't really gone into the details of the matter. And, of course, they closed last week. Mary, you and I had several good meals at both restaurants.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we did.
What are you going to miss? We'll get into the business implications and some of the other speculation here in a minute, but just as a pure obituary, what are you going to miss about Hunky Dory and Bernadine's?
Oh my gosh, kind of getting chills just thinking about it. Graham was and is a fantastic chef. You and I had an amazing meal there. You took me there the first time that I was able to go there, and just the I-10 platter, the seafood that he put together, his presence in the dining room, such a talented chef. I'm excited to see what's next for him, but I will miss his presence in that dining room. And as far as Richard Knight goes, we've been friends with Richard since his days at Feast across from our restaurant on Lower Westheimer. And he used to come and have a drink at the bar after he was done, and many memories speaking with him in the past. And I was so excited for him to have his own restaurant there. The bar at Hunky Dory was particularly memorable for me. Their selection was extremely good as far as whiskeys and scotches and everything else, bourbons that they had. The patio I really liked, the use of the trees and the natural landscape, and the fact that these buildings were built from scratch. It's not often that a restaurateur gets the ability to envision something completely from scratch and work with some of the best architects and designers.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I will miss all of those things. I'll miss that ridiculous cochon de lait that had like four different parts of pig cooked separately and then fused together and seared so it was crispy on the outside. You know, I had family events at Hunky Dory. You know, I took awkward first dates to both restaurants. It's, you know, it was kind of a go-to for me. And you know, a lot of really hardworking people were negatively affected by what happened with Tredsack's financial difficulties. And it's unfortunate. Almost all of them that I'm aware of have gone on to other opportunities. But, you know, that sense of this incredible collection of talent in one space at one time, you know, it may be a while before we see a restaurant that replicates something quite as ambitious as to open two completely separate restaurants on the same property with that much talent in the building.
I mean, Eric, just to give you an idea, so we just celebrated our 5-year anniversary, and, you know, Chris Kuzak, one of the owners of Tredsack, opened Downhouse around the same time that we opened. And so, you know, Chef Olivia and I are focused on our restaurant, but within that 5-year time span, plus or minus, he went on to open up all of these concepts. And to see the fruition of Hunky Dory and Bernadine's come to such an abrupt end is a really, really tough thing.
So do you have a sense maybe of where Tredsack goes from here? I mean, they're down to it's kind of been a weird reset because they're basically back where they started in 2014 with Johnny's Gold Brick, D&T Drive-In, and Downhouse without the other concepts that opened up during 2015 and the beginning of 2016.
You know, I don't know what's next for them, but it's largely going to depend on how these entities were formed, and I don't know all the details about that. It does look that like Johnny's Gold Brick is in a different entity than D&T and Downhouse, so that will probably give them the best chance going forward, and it's honestly one of my favorite bars. I drink there probably once a week. The bartenders there are fantastic. Downhouse and D&T, who knows? I guess that will be up to the bankruptcy judge, but I'm sure many residents of the Heights will hope that they come out on the other side of that.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Downhouse has been a neighborhood institution almost since the day it opened. You know, it was originally envisioned as kind of a coffee shop with a bar component, and they figured out real quickly that they had opened a restaurant instead of a coffee shop, and it's just been, you know, one of those reliable go-tos, especially for, I mean, weeknight dinners, especially for brunch on the weekends. Of course, Vice President Joe Biden ate there a couple years ago.
Yeah, just for lunch even. I mean, whenever I'm in the Heights and I have meetings and I need to schedule it somewhere central, I mean, I would have a lot of lunch meetings at Downhouse. It's a super great spot. It's conveniently located. I just, you know, I hope that the remaining concepts make it because I think they've made a big impact in the neighborhood.
And then, you know, certainly you've opened a restaurant in Montrose, and it's a different neighborhood in terms of diners' expectations and what works and what doesn't than what happens in the Heights. But as you said, you're a frequent Heights visitor.
Yes.
Do you have a sense of what you would like to see replace Hunky Dory and Bernadine's?
Oh my gosh! So the tricky component for that restaurant is that they have a shared private dining room, and I believe that their kitchens are completely separate. So I guess going forward, it's going to be, you know, whether one operator is going to come in there and take the whole thing. And the only, you know, type of concept I think that needs that much square footage or can make that work would be a steakhouse type concept, perhaps. And then the other alternative is, you know, chopping it up into a couple of different spaces and maybe making it more casual, which I think that's more of the style diner that's in the Heights these days is casual. I don't know that a high-end steakhouse would be the right fit for that building, but it's such a beautiful space.
All right, so Eater Houston published a rumor this morning that Ford Fry, the chef from Atlanta who owns State of Grace, I should say, he's a Houston native, but his success, his career has been in Atlanta, is looking at the building. There's a room that rumor is out there. Is that something you would be interested in? A new concept from Ford Fry?
I think that would be fantastic. I mean, State of Grace, I know, is one of your favorite restaurants. It's just a few blocks from my house. They did a beautiful job with the design. I could see them actually taking over the space and not having to do a whole lot to make it their own. I just wonder if they'd take the whole space or if they would only want a part of the space.
All right. So here's the other rumor. This is what Eater didn't publish, but this is what I'm hearing from my sources in the restaurant world. And I will emphasize that this is strictly rumor territory. This is not guaranteed. And for the record, Ford Fries people have said, yes, we're looking at the building, but we don't have a deal yet. And so we all know that could fall apart at any second. And by the time this podcast comes out, I could be totally wrong. But Ford has a couple of Tex-Mex concepts in Atlanta that do really well. And the rumor circulating in the restaurant community is that he might be bringing one of those, to the building that used to house Hunky Dory and Bernadine's. Are you interested in eating Ford Fry's Tex-Mex?
Ooh, I don't know anything about his Tex-Mex. He's from Houston, so that makes me want to believe in him a little bit more than I would just somebody from Atlanta and not knowing their background. Those spaces are so elegant. I'd hate to see somebody take a sledgehammer to them and make it into a Tex-Mex spot, but maybe it's upscale and he can keep the interiors intact.
Yeah,
I don't know.
If it's more like an El Tiempo style Tex-Mex or maybe a Ninfa's on Navigation Tex-Mex.
I'm thinking Caracol and like upscale, like aesthetic. Like
Max, yeah. it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. That's the rumor. As I said, you know, the difficulty in recording these in advance and releasing them a few days later is sometimes fast-moving events overtake us, but, you know, I'll either look like a psychic or an idiot.
It's like your
few days.
It's your version of Page Six rumors.
Right.
You're listening to What's Eric Eating?
So let's move on from News of the Week to Restaurants of the Week. You and I had dinner together a couple weeks ago at a new restaurant in Chinatown that's attracting a lot of buzz. It's called Chengdu Taste. It comes to Houston from Los Angeles, and it's a Szechuan-style restaurant. Certainly, you know, Mala Szechuan has made a huge splash. Pepper Twins, originally known as Cooking Girl, has made a huge splash in Montrose. So Szechuan-style cuisine is hot, literally. If you've eaten a lot of it, you understand what I'm talking about. And also figuratively, it's done very well here in the city. And Chengdu Taste is ranked the 25th best restaurant in Los Angeles by Los Angeles Times critic Jonathan Gold. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner, so he definitely knows what he's talking about. Kenji Lopez-Alt, the author of The Food Lab on Sirius Eats, a cookbook author and food writer, called Chengdu Taste the best Szechuan restaurant in America. Mary, when we were eating there a couple of weeks ago, did you feel like you were in the presence of greatness?
I was so incredibly ecstatic. It was one of the best meals I've had this past year, and literally every single dish that we ordered I was pleased with. I mean, some of the dishes were unexpected, but everything was out of the park. I mean, they nailed it.
Do you remember, did you have a favorite?
I did. It's probably not going to be your favorite, but my kind of rule of thumb for restaurants is that if they can't do the basic things really well, they're not going to do the obscure things really well. So for the basic dishes that I really, really liked, the Kung Pao chicken was the best I have ever had, period.
Yeah, I was a little bit skeptical when we decided to order that, but, you know, the chicken was juicy, had a ton of peanuts. It had all of that mala, that tingling sensation you get from the Szechuan peppercorns. It was a really good dish. For me, it was the toothpick lamb, which is kind of a signature item for them.
Yeah.
Little bite-sized pieces of lamb, literally served on toothpicks. I would hate to be the prep cook whose job that is to individually toothpick the lamb. But with this cumin heavy rub, just had that like good lamb funk, not in a bad way, with the spice mix. That was a dish I could not stop eating.
The fish soup was really good, and I forget the exact ingredient component of it.
It's the water boiled fish with like a green Szechuan peppercorn broth was very memorable.
Fantastic. I did like that we were able to go next door and purchase drinks and then bring them over. So the fact that it was BYOB was a nice plus.
Yeah, it's BYOB. It's located right next to H Mart on Bel Air in Chinatown. It used to be a Banana Leaf location. This restaurant opened so quietly, it doesn't even have a Houston Facebook page, never mind a website.
No reservations.
And it was flying a little bit under the media radar when we got there at 8 o'clock on a Saturday night, and it was still at an hour wait. The article on Culture Map absolutely exploded in terms of the number of people it reached on Facebook. The most popular thing I've written probably in a couple of months. So that wait may be even a little bit longer now. If you're curious to try it, I might suggest trying to hit it for lunch if you can, or certainly going earlier in the dinner hour. But, you know, that water boiled fish, the toothpick lamb, the how did you feel about the cold rabbit dish? That's my last question, and we'll move
on. Okay, so the cold rabbit dish, I loved everything about it, except I didn't know that it was going to be coming out cold. And so the first bite that I took, I was like, oh, okay, that's different. But the flavors were great, and I actually took some of the sauce when we got the fried rice and poured it over the fried rice, and that was excellent.
Yeah, this is rabbit in Little Sister's Secret Sauce. It's one of the very first dishes on the menu. It's something they're known for. The temperature caught me off guard too, but that sauce is so spicy and addictive that I fought my way through it. We've talked about some of the changes going on in the Heights, but let's talk about a couple of new openings. Talking about Heights Beer Garden and King's Beer House. Now, Heights Beer Garden is the new concept from the owners of Wooster's Garden in Midtown. Very much a bar in the sense that there's the Heights Beer Garden side that has almost 100 taps, and including beer, wine, and then it has the Wooster's Annex. It's a cocktail bar, but it has a pretty significant food component. Brandon Silva, who's worked for both Holly's and Uchi, is the culinary director for the Kirby Group. That's the company that owns Heights Beer Garden. He's got a pretty extensive menu. And then King's Beer House is it's in Lazy Brook Timber Grove. It's right near Rainbow Lodge. That's kind of an evolution from King's Beer Garden in Pearland. Has a beautiful landscaped outdoor seating area, a true German-style beer garden, and, of course, 40 taps of its own with a ton of German beer, German food, sausages, schnitzel, more. Let me start at the beginning. What do you think of Heights Beer Garden?
Okay, so Heights Beer Garden will definitely be a playground for me. I mean, I think it's for adults. They say that they're open to all people, families included and everything else, and I think that's awesome that they're being inclusive, but I think the reality of it is it's a great place to go with your friends after work or on a date night. I like that it's not just a beer garden, that there's a really heavy cocktail component to it. So one side's cocktails and the other side's beer. I like that they have both, and their chef is fantastic. So I'm excited that they have food, but that's probably not the number one reason I'm going to be going there. I'm going to be going there for their cocktails and for their outdoors. They've done a fantastic job with the outdoors. They've got the misters and the fans and umbrellas. And I love the location and the people behind this group. And it's kind of a spot I would go there with my friends. As opposed to King's Beer House, I would also go there with my friends, but I think it's more family friendly and more of a restaurant than a bar. Whereas I think Heights Beer Garden is more of a bar and a restaurant secondarily. But their German beer list at King's Beer House is exceptional.
Yeah, I mean, they have, I'm not gonna do it justice. They have the Vitus that has been called once upon a time a couple of years ago the best beer in the world. It's kind of a triple Hefeweizen. It's $12 for a half liter, which I'm sure is kind of what it costs. But that was the one thing about King's Beer House that was surprising to me was, you know, I had a schnitzel, I had an order of chicken wings, and I had a beer, and with tax and tip, it was almost $50. That's the one thing about that place is it feels great. I mean, when you're sitting out in that beer garden, there's a fountain, it's fully landscaped, it's beautiful. Just the pricing sneaks up on you just a little bit.
It does. I think it's a little deceptively expensive, but if you're really into the German beers, it's worth it. I was there for happy hour, and I think it was maybe $1 off beers, something like that. I do remember Heights Beer Garden. Their happy hour probably, to me, is one of the best in the city.
Yeah, their happy hour is fantastic. It's half off house cocktails, half off glasses of wine, and I think it's $5 drafts, but it could be $3 drafts.
I think it's three. We'll have to check. But
yeah, they're both on. They're both Heist Beer Garden and Wooster's Annex Happy Hours are on Culture Map right now in our newest Happy Hour roundup. So you can check that out for all the details. Mary, thanks so much for joining me on the show today. I'll be back in a minute with Ryan Lachane from Riel Restaurant in Montrose. He and I are going to talk about what it's been like to go from sous chef to chef owner, the changes that he's made over the first 6 months of that restaurant, some other topics. Mary, before you leave, why don't you tell us where we can find you on the web and on Instagram and all those places?
Sure. So our website is leolivierhouston.com. And Instagram, same thing, leolivierhouston. We're big supporters of Instagram. We love the images that come through from chef in the kitchen and on the floor with our wine list. Every day we kind of have a wine pick of the day and many more features. So Instagram, Facebook, and on our website.
And of course, the nice thing about your Instagram account is we get a little bit of glimpse in your personal life every now and then, usually after a couple of cocktails. So that makes you a particularly fun follow. Yes. You can, of course, follow me on Instagram at Eric Sandler. Follow Culture Map on Instagram. It's Culture Map everywhere you want to go. And of course, I'll have more news, notes, everything that's going on in the world of Houston restaurants. Please, if you haven't, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a comment and a rating. But like Katie Nolan says, only if it's 5 stars and only if it's nice. I'll be right back with Ryan Lachane. Stay tuned.
You're listening to What's Eric Eating?
My guest this week is Ryan Lachane. He's the chef owner of Riel Restaurant, which opened in January in Montrose. Before Ryan opened his own restaurant, he worked at Reef. He worked at Underbelly. He's a former minor league hockey player, a man of diverse talents. Ryan, welcome to What's Eric Eating? How are you?
I'm good, man. Thanks for having me.
Ryan, I just want to kind of start at the beginning. I think Riel has emerged as one of the restaurants people are really talking about as one of the more promising new restaurants that's open this year. How did you develop the ideas? Well, first of all, just tell people who maybe haven't been there a little bit about what Riel is.
You know, we're small, I guess you'd call it modern American restaurant. We're 65 seats, open 6 days a week, dinner only. Small menu, 15 items.
So I think what makes the menu so interesting is that you take the kind of Southern Gulf Coast thing that certainly Reef and Underbelly are both known for, and you put your own spin on it by blending it with your Canadian heritage or your Canadian upbringing and your Ukrainian heritage. How did that come together? How did you make a menu where you have Japanese Gulf fish karage and pierogi, like, sitting right next to each other?
You know, when we developed the menu, we just decided that, you know, we're just going to do what we wanted to do. Like, we're there, you know, I don't think there's one, you know, there, the word Ukrainian gets thrown around, the word French Canadian gets thrown around, that kind of stuff. But we're going to, you know, there, we're going to do what we want to do. We find the ingredients, and as a staff, myself, you know, my sous chef EJ and the cooks, we do what we think is right with it. You know, I was adamant on having things that were near and dear to me, like pierogies and borscht on the menu, things that I grew up eating that I like to eat. So that's, you know, kind of where that came from. And, you know, things like a torche that you know, are very, very Canadian, or other things. But, you know, as far as the Southern stuff and the Japanese stuff goes, like I said, when we get the ingredients in, we let them kind of, you know, speak to us, and we figure out what we can or how we can utilize them best.
Have you been, or let me put it to you like this. What dishes on the menu have been the most successful? What's been the biggest surprise for you?
You know, the hanger steak and the pierogies is our biggest seller. You know, it's our steak and potatoes kind of take. And that's what we sell the most of every night. Like we sell, you know, on a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, we sell 30 plus of them. You know, plus the pierogies too, we sell them individually. There's a weekend, I think we sold like, you know, 100 and something individually. So it's just like bowls of pierogies going out there. I never thought in a million years it would be like that. But yeah, we sell a lot of pierogies there.
And then are there, ideas that you've tried that maybe people haven't responded to, or what's that learning process been like?
Well, there's, I think it's like anything else. Like, you know, when you're working at other restaurants, you know, especially when I was at Underbelly, and that we changed the menu so much, and there's these dishes you put together that you think are just going to kill it, that you love, and no one really cares about them, and you can't, you know, you don't understand it, but that's just, you know, that's just the way it is. We were pretty even starting off across the board of how much stuff we sold. You know, the menu is very small. So a lot of people get a lot of things on it, with the exception of, you know, the caviar or the big steak. But, you know, the things, like I said, the, you know, the pierogies, the steak, the cauliflower is another huge seller for us, the tempura cauliflower, which we kind of put on there as something, like I said, we wanted something kind of like chicken wings. So there's a hot sauce with the tempura kind of thing and some carrots and celery. And we also sell a lot of that too. We also put like a fried rice dish on the menu with some duck confit and some egg yolk and some duck liver, and that is one of our best sellers now as well.
And I know you've recently rolled out a happy hour menu. How's that going, and how is the bar kind of doing as a separate component from the restaurant?
You know, the happy hour, it's slowly coming along. You know, it's kind of hit and miss. I think happy hour is something you kind of have to earn in a neighborhood like that, you know, where, and I'm sure a lot of people that were in the neighborhood were going to Mockingbird and things. And now that that's not around anymore, we're hoping that maybe they'll come over and try us out. But it's, you know, sometimes we're really busy, and sometimes, you know, there's a couple people in there. So it's only, you know what, a month old. So we're not too worried.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the neighborhood has really embraced it. I know Jennifer Caswell was on the podcast recently. She said you had people bringing you cookies.
Yeah, when we first were open, we weren't even open yet, but we, myself and Chris Fleischman and my Sue EJ were there. You know, we're doing some late nights, doing some work, stocking the bar, and one of the neighbors would bring us cookies. We'd hear a knock on the door at like 11:30, 12 at night, and she'd just kind of open the door and hand us some cookies to eat. So it was nice.
So, but now that you've opened, are there still cookies coming? Or
there's not as many cookies coming these days. But
that could be that there's more cars in the neighborhood now. Yeah. She may not be totally.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do think you are playing an interesting role, because you're on Fairview. You're not on Westheimer. Mm-hmm. So you really need that neighborhood. You're either going to be a destination, which I think for people who are passionate about food, they've been seeking you out. But you do need that neighborhood support. I mean, just like Roost has it, they're right down the street. And to a lesser extent, just like Paulie's does, because they're right around the corner.
You know, the neighborhood has been awesome to us. Even on nights where we're a little bit slower on the books, we have like literally people walk over, like walking in, like from all of the neighborhoods. So, you know, we've doubled our covers some nights from people just walking in the neighborhood. And we have, you know, people that are coming in now, you know, two times a week, three times a week to eat. So yeah, the neighborhood's been great to us. It's been very, very good.
And I have to ask you about the caviar, just because it's so decadent. It's well, just tell people about, I hate that. Tell me about, or talk about the blah, blah, blah. It's so lazy, but please describe the caviar preparation, so just because I think it's so over the top.
We do three types of caviar. We do, you know, we do an American caviar, a Russian caviar, and a Siberian caviar. And we do like the classic kind of like accoutrements with it or whatever, you know, like we do the egg yolk, the passed egg white, and some capers. And then we use cultured butter. So we culture our own butter there, which I think gives it a nice touch. And with some buckwheat bellinis. It's one of those things you either sell a lot of them or you don't, you know.
Is that one of those things where if one table orders it, then like two or three more tables follow?
Yeah, you know, you see it go out. It's kind of a, you know, it's on
it
the
goes out piece. On a giant wooden plank.
Yeah, yeah. So usually one goes out, a couple more will go out, but it's a lot. I think it's a lot of fun. You know, instead of doing champagne with it, we have some vodka. We keep in the freezer. We keep it ice cold, so we do like ice cold vodka with it. Kind of more like a Russian kind of caviar service thing.
And then the big steak, it's changed a couple of times. What is the current steak that you're serving?
We're doing a bone-in ribeye now. Man, I forget how much it weighs, but yeah, it's
like a 40-something steak, right?
It's a commitment. It's a commitment. Like if you're going to order it, it's a lot of food. You know, there's some carrots and green beans go with it. And we do the, you know, the béarnaise, the barbecue sauce, and the hotel butter with it, and a couple fried eggs, and usually people just they add on like 6 pierogies with it too, just to
Just because it's not calorically enough of a commitment.
It's not enough, yeah.
But I think what's so interesting is there's no tricks, right? You don't sous vide it. You don't.
Well, we do sous vide it. We have them bagged up in sous vide, and that's basically just because we're not a big restaurant. We have a big giant grill. It's just to pick it up a little bit quicker, you know, because, you know, we're limited back there, excuse me, with our size. We have to do some stuff like that. So it's not like a trick we're sous vide or nothing, but yeah, we keep it to a certain temp and then we sear
it off. Then it gets pan seared, right? I mean, I've seen EJ working that thing.
Works out. We do it on the grill.
Okay. But are you surprised by how popular that's been, or is that?
I'm not surprised. I know I was adamant on having at least one shareable item on the menu. So I'm not surprised. I think it's good. I think it's a good deal. I don't think it's really that overpriced. It's like I said, it's a lot of food.
And then you opened in winter. We're moving into summer. How do you see the menu evolving to match the seasons?
We're not overhauling it, but we have maybe, you know, 4 or 5 different things that are coming on in the next week or so. We've already changed, you know, 2 or 3 things. You know, we were still getting a lot of carrots and a lot of things. There was that freeze there, so we kind of had a second season of carrots and some root veg and turnips and that kind of stuff. So we, you know, continue to use those. But we're getting some tomatoes and some corn. So in the next, you know, little while, there'll be quite a change on it.
Are there ingredients that you're like just kind of biding your time, like excited that you get to use?
I love eating corn, so I'm waiting for the corn to come in and the corn to be good. And also, you know, tomatoes and stuff like that. We can really, you know, freshen things up and lighten things up.
And then the other thing is you've been kind of working your way through the review cycle. The reviews have been pretty positive overall. What's been your impression reading them, or how, what's it like to see your restaurant through other people's eyes?
You know, it's different. I don't, you know, you try not to take, you know, anything to heart in that, but sometimes it's tough. You put a lot of, you know, a lot of time and effort, and, you know, not only myself, but like other people's are sacrificing for you to do this kind of stuff. So obviously you want, you know, you want a good review. You want, you know, those stars or people that write positive about it. But I understand things can't be, you know, everything can't be positive, but, you know, I stand behind what we do there. And I think, you know, those guys that cook there and work, they're doing a good job, but, you know, you can't make everybody like it.
Have you read a specific criticism where you're like, yeah, that's legit, we need to change that?
Yeah, yes and no. You know, there's some stuff that I think, yeah, like maybe this is one of the weaker dishes on the menu. You know, and there's things I think that we do there. We all cook very aggressively there. There's a lot of vinegar and there's a lot of acid and things, and we're in your face. So, you know, maybe some people think it's salty or this and that, and I would tend to disagree on some of it, but, you know, to each his own.
One of the things that Nathan Ketchman and I talked about a few weeks ago is we're trying to identify the next generation. You know, now that Chris Shepherd and Justin Yu and Hugo Ortega have won their James Beard Awards, we're trying to sort of identify the next chefs from Houston who could potentially earn that kind of recognition. Your name keeps coming up.
I think that's great, and it's nice to hear. You know, we were working hard to you know, to move forward to something like that.
I mean, do you feel like that's, is that a process that you can control, or do you just like go to work and serve good food every day?
I don't think it's something that we can really control. I think at the end of the day, you just have to go to work and cook and try to make good food, and what's going to happen is going to happen. Like I said, I can't make everyone like everything I do. You know, we want everything liked, but if you don't like it, you don't like it. And that's it. And if someone important comes in and doesn't like it, then that's that, you know. It's also a business. We have to run a business here. So, you know, running after all that kind of stuff is nice, but I have to pay the bills. The lights have to stay on.
I mean, you did a lot of traveling both during your time as a cook and then before the restaurant opened. What did you see that sort of helped prepare you for this?
you know, you can learn. I know I stage a lot of different restaurants, and I've been very fortunate to cook with a bunch of different people and you know, work with guys and talk to guys. And honestly, I can't think of anyone that has said or done anything negative. Like, out of all the things I've done, like, I don't think I've met anyone that's, you know, kind of been shitty to me. They've all been really good guys. I've got a lot of good, you know, advice, and stuff. And I keep in contact with a lot of guys. So it's been great. So, you know, you can learn, you know, you learn different things, and I try to take the positives and the negatives from all these different, you know, experiences I get to have.
Is there like a text chain of like Indy Chefs Week, alumni that are trading tips or, suggestions?
I don't know. There is. I don't know how many of us are still on there. Maybe there's 15 guys or something from the first Indie Chefs Week in Austin I did. I don't know if there's tips. There's just a bunch of banter and a bunch of guys, you know, talking shit and stuff like that mostly.
What's it like for you to go from the guy who was sort of behind the scenes and working for other people to being in charge? What's been the biggest change in your day to day?
Well, trying to run a business is the hardest part. Like, if you know, cooking's pretty easy and it's fun and it's the best part of it. You get to go to work and cook and do all these cool things. But, you know, trying to run a restaurant and be a businessman, it's tough. There's a lot of things that, you know, you just don't know. You know, stuff's expensive. As a sous chef coming in, you know, to restaurants when you're opening them, you show up there and basically everything's bought, and all you have to do is make sure your food costs and everything is going well and that kind of stuff. And besides that, you're just kind of cooking. But, you know, now I have to worry about the leak in the roof and, you know, paying the bills and making sure this happens and making sure, you know, other stuff happens. So it's an eye opener, and it's a whole different side that, you know, I guess you have to know as being a business owner.
What was the, like, the one biggest expense that you were like, I can't believe that's what this costs?
Tables and chairs. I could not believe that tables and chairs cost so much money. Like, literally, we saw some chairs, like, man, that chair's awesome. With that, $300. I'm like, each? Like, chairs are...
Is it made of gold?
Like, chairs are $300. I couldn't believe it. But, yeah, it's something that you don't have in your budget that you don't know. No, there's so many things that are so, you know, expensive that you need to have that you just kind of gotta figure out.
And what's it like, sort of leading the kitchen, or are you, you're sort of, are you cooking less? Are you mentoring more? Like, what's that process?
I cook way less. You know, I'm very, very fortunate. I landed a very good staff that's, you know, very hard to come by these days. You know, I have a lot of veteran guys in there. So, you know, a lot of it is, you know, when we, you know, started doing our menu, I had an idea of what I want. I want this. And there were some things that I've done before that I know what to make. And I could say, hey, guys, like, this is what I want. Let's make them, or I can make it once and, you know, it's done. Or now that we're changing the menu, you know, these are the ideas I have, and guys are coming up with. They can do it just as good as me, or sometimes better. So having that staff there is, like, invaluable to me. It opens up more time for me to deal with other things, with my, you know, the business aspect of owning a restaurant.
And then, how do you sort of balance, like, maintaining your creative vision with giving the people who work for you kind of their own opportunity to shine?
You know, I tell those guys, like, I expect them to bring something to the table. It's part of their job. And I don't want the restaurant to be stagnant where we're just doing the same thing over and over again. Like, I don't want the guys to be robots in there. I tell them, like, you know, here's what's going on. I try to give these guys everything they can to do their job properly, you know. Number one, so they, you know, they have the opportunity to do something. And number two, so there's no excuses. And they can say, well, I don't have this or I don't have that. If they want something, they want an ingredient and they're going to make something, then they get it.
Are you satisfied with kind of your not quite 6 months in? Are you kind of where you thought you'd be? Are you busier than you thought you'd be? Kind of where are you overall?
You know, when we opened up kind of quick, and we were a lot busier and we got a lot more, you know, press in that I thought we would, which is really, really nice. But you know, it's one of those things where you start off and everything's great and that, and now we're kind of just, you know, it's like, I don't want to say the honeymoon's over, but you know, it's like, okay, now we have a restaurant here and this is what has to happen and blah, blah, blah. You know, we're kind of getting our legs a little bit where, you know, it's not just we go in there and we work 100 hours a week and you know, you're just, everyone's all hands on deck. So we're slowly figuring it out. And like I said, I can't complain. We haven't had any major problems, you know, so far. The response to the restaurant's been good. So yeah, I'm happy.
I mean, do you ever just like stand in it and just be like, I can't believe this is my
first. I can't fucking believe it sometimes. I'll tell you, like you're the last guy there at night, or I'm sitting with EJ and Fleischman. And it's like, man, I can't believe like someone let me do this. You know, it's, yeah.
And for people who haven't met him, I just think Chris Fleischman is like one of the like old school front of house. I mean, he's a young guy, but he just has that kind of old school sensibility in the front of the house. He remembers people's names. He knows what they like to drink. What's it like working with him?
Chris is good. I worked with Chris. I know Chris from Stella Sola. He was a server at Stella Sola when I was a line cook there. And that was one of my biggest worries was finding a good GM for the restaurant, you know, because, excuse me, I don't know how to run a bar or do that. Like, I know how to go drink at a bar and that kind of stuff, but I don't know how to, so he, you know, he came in and he did all that stuff. So he's been great. And he's you know, he's a good friend of mine. I was lucky to find him. I thought he was still maybe at PAX, and you know, he wasn't. So I was lucky to, you know, I called him. As soon as I found out, I called him like 5 minutes later and said, you know, hey, we need a guy. Would you like to talk? And he said, yeah. So, you know, things worked out.
I think one of the things I really like about Riel is it's an open kitchen. And you can sit at that counter and watch you guys cook. So if something goes wrong, like you can't go old school. You can't like throw pans and yell at people.
I haven't, not, you know, like knock on wood again, nothing's really gone wrong. You know, EJ, you know, he runs most of that place. He does the day-to-day stuff in the kitchen and he has a good handle on everyone there. And he knows what I want and that kind of stuff. So there's not a lot of, you know, me having to, you know, yell at anyone that he can see when things are going wrong. Like, he's another guy that has like, you know, beyond expectations. He's been great. He does everything there, like absolutely everything. Like, he knows what I want before I even need it. We've only been working together for, you know, 4 or 5 months. Yeah, he's, you know, he's been great. I'm lucky to have the guy.
Yeah, I mean, he's someone who brought just a ton of experience. He was the executive chef at Downhouse. He worked for Brandy Key at, you know, Copa and Saltair.
He opened those big giant restaurants for him. So doing this, you know, we both had to learn how to survive in a smaller atmosphere, how to order properly, how to, you know, cook smaller things and do all that. Because, you know, the restaurants that I've worked at, the restaurant he's worked at, they've all been big places. So, you know, you have, you know, you're ordering, you know, $2,000 worth of fish at a time. You know, when I'm ordering 200. You know, on a busy day. So we had to figure that out, how to work on a smaller scale. And he's done it great, man. That guy, you know, like I said, I can't say enough about him. He's done a really good job.
I mean, but that small size, I mean, do you like that you can, I mean, you can touch every plate, right? On any given
day. That was the deal. That was the thing when I opened it. I had no desire to open a big restaurant like that. Like, I didn't want to do it. You know, we wanted things to be a little bit more intimate, and I wanted to be able to see everything go out. I didn't want to get to the point where we're doing 400 covers a night. Like, that doesn't inspire me, or that doesn't turn me on at all to do that many people. You know,
no, I mean, it's 65 seats. So if you're doing maybe 120, that's got to be a pretty busy night.
Yeah, you know, we've pushed out, you know, 130, 140, you know, at the most. And I guess maybe it's all relative, I guess. I don't know, but... everything comes through me and EJ there, you know, how the line's set up and that. So we see everything. You know, if we don't like it, it doesn't go out. And that's that.
I mean, I know I asked you about ingredients a little bit earlier. Are there other things that you would like to see as you get through the first 6 months and head towards the year mark? Are there specific goals that you have for the restaurant?
yeah, I want to stay busy. You know, that's the number one goal. You know, like getting accolades and stuff is always nice, but you know, once you come to the realization that you're a small business owner, that's your number one priority. Like there's people depending on me. People have jobs, you know, that are depending on me to pay them on time and do stuff. So yeah, that's our number one thing there is to stay busy and to stay fresh and, you know, for everyone to you know, to be happy. I'm a firm believer that if everyone that works in your restaurant is happy and the cooks are happy that the diners can taste it, you know, I think nowadays, people that go and eat lots, so-called foodies or whatever, they're smart. They're somewhat intelligent. They know that if they're, you know, you can't trick them really, you know? So I want us to be proud of the product we put out. And I think that, you know, it'll help us in the long run.
And then I know you said you're spending just a ton of time at the restaurant. Have you gotten out recently? Have you been to any new restaurants that you liked?
I've really been nowhere. You know, it seems like we've been open forever, but we've only been open for really 4 months.
Yeah.
It hasn't been that long. So, you know, the majority of my time is spent there. You know, we can maybe, man, I can't even tell you where, if we've gone out to eat really anywhere now.
And then we had Brian Caswell and Jennifer Caswell on the podcast. A couple of weeks ago, Brian talked about Oxbow 7, his new restaurant. As someone who's worked with him, how excited are you that he's kind of getting back in the game?
I'm really excited for him. You know, Brian's been really, really good to me. You know, he's always, he's always given me good advice. And I talk to him probably more than I talk to anybody about the industry and that kind of stuff. So yeah, I'm excited that he's, you know, that he's doing something like that. Cause I know a lot of people that know about Brian, you know, he's, what, Reese's been open for 10 years. You know, he has these other things. Brian's actually a really good cook. Like, he's a good line cook. And when it was funny, I remember when I first started working there as a cook, to see him, you know, he's a big dude. He can get on the line and he can move, you know, like he can, you know, if you're in trouble there, he can bail you up. So Brian's a good cook. And I think a lot of people in town have been waiting for this for a while to see him kind of do something, you know, like this.
All right. Well, Ryan LaShane, thank you so much for joining me. You can follow Ryan on Twitter at rlach, R-L-A-C-H. You can follow him on Instagram at rlashane, L-A-C-H-A-I-N-E. What's the Instagram handle for Riel?
It's Riel Houston.
So on Instagram at Riel Houston, on the web at RielHTX. And of course, you can follow me on Twitter at eSandler, on Instagram at Eric Sandler. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. You can rate us and leave us a comment. But as Katie Nolan says, only if it's 5 stars and only if it's nice. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week.
Thanks, Eric.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's,